Space Oddity.
Hello and welcome to the 19th episode of Space Oddity. Today, we are going to get a sneak preview of the upcoming book, An Atlas of Spaceship Figures, edited and directed by Ignacio Farias and Silke Stilz, our two organizers from last year's symposium. The Atlas will get hopefully published in autumn this year, and it's less about the four dominant spaceship figures we discussed in the previous episode and at the symposium, rather about discovering and exemplifying less obvious and familiar figures of social reality. For this publication, Silke and Ignacio invited and cooperated with the Viennese artist Nikolaus Ganstra, and together they did several multimodal workshops with each subproject of the CRC. And now, we are tuning in parts of the performance lecture from the symposium Spaceship Figures in the Anthropocene, which took place in October 2023 at the IC Berlin. The introduction lecture will get followed up by a short exchange between Silke and Ignacio reflecting last year's conference theme in the Atlas, and we are going to listen to two out of four so-called vectors of refiguration, namely extimacy and uninhability, through the stories Blind Date and Where to Flee, discovering the spatial figures Saloon and Compound. If you want to watch the whole performance lecture, check our website, the link is in the show notes. So enjoy and see you in the next one.
Our collaboration began in spring of 2022 with the goal of stimulating and reflecting on the development of theory within the context of the CRC. It comprises 16 research projects from the fields of sociology, anthropology, geography, communication studies, architecture, planning, and visual arts. The overarching hypothesis guiding our research is that societal transformation can no longer be understood as an epochal shift from modernity to postmodernity to late modernity, or from the nation state to globalization, or from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. Rather, it should be seen as a multifaceted, simultaneous interplay of different spatial logics that reinforce and complement each other, but also generate tensions and conflicts. Empirically, the manifestation of these overlapping spatial figures can be observed in various forms, such as the changing notions of home and ontological security, conflicting regimes, as well as conflicts over territorial demarcation or the increasing fragmentation of the digital public sphere. Theorizing in such a large, interdisciplinary, and socially diverse research consortium is not an easy task. That is why we decided to use experimental and playful methods to get into conversation with the CRC researchers. We initiated this process by conducting two-hour multimodal workshops with all 16 sub-projects, in which we asked the researchers to tell us about their work and research topics based on narrative and speculative questions, as well as props, not only verbally, but also visually and performatively. We had a table in the middle, and the request was to bring empirical materials onto the table and use a vast set of additional materials to build connections and describe scenarios. Our method can loosely be compared with what Matt Retto has called critical making, to describe the combination of critical thinking with hands-on making, but also to speculative design, as it was aimed at materially exploring research fields as spaces of non-plausible possibilities. So we wanted to create some chaos in the beginning. The guiding idea for the workshops was to test the interplay between analytical and visual thinking. We are particularly interested in how theoretical concepts and ideas can be translated into diagrams, annotations, collages of figures, and how these in turn can be made fruitful for processes of theorizing. In fact, there is a whole body of stimulating literature that suggests that visual elements prove most valuable when they are open, that is, when they function as dynamic tools for thoughtful exploration. In order to theorize with the help of images, diagrams, or figures, they should have the capacity to trigger our visual and theoretical imagination. This implies that they must be speculative in nature and primarily encourage abductive forms of reasoning. We videotaped this mix of visual and analytical thinking as it unfolded on the workshop table, and these recordings served as a basis for Nikolaus to develop his own table configurations, a concept that hasn't been introduced yet, but which refers to the assemblage of people and things that come together with a figure. Table configurations are three-dimensional and multi-material diachromatic compositions of keywords, lines, objects, and gestures on a black background that Nikolaus arranged in his Vienna studio in response to and as an artistic reflection of the workshops we did with the sub-projects. In the book, each of the CRC's 16 sub-projects is represented by a table configuration. They allow the reader to think visually while navigating through the respective research topics as if they were traveling on a map with their finger, and promote a perspective that goes beyond a purely analytical examination of the CRC's subject matters. By way of zooming in, they also allow for in-depth exploration of individual aspects.
On the other hand, we identified stories told in the workshops that in our eyes capture intriguing conceptual moments in terms of spatial analysis, and then ask the researchers to put these stories into paper. The outcome of this rather time-intensive process is an engaging collection of 45 stories that translates some of the empirical findings into literary forms, field observations, into compelling narratives, and offer also speculations or speculative reinterpretations of research topics. The stories were painstakingly developed in close collaboration with editor Marc Saur. Although our Atlas of Spatial Figures is largely composed of artistic and literary formats, it is a book about experimental forms of exploring space in a scientific research context. First and foremost, the book tests making a shift from analysis as the standard mode of social science writing towards description. The core of the book is indeed storytelling. 45 literary, ethnographic, sci-fi stories that show how things are or might be in different corners of the world. By doing that, these stories tell larger stories of the or about the refiguration of spaces. We call our book Atlas because it collects spatial figures. For each story we collected from the CRC projects, we define a unique spatial figure that CRC researchers either encounter while doing fieldwork or use while talking and writing about their fields, or also figures that we saw in their stories. The list includes the following: abode, address, barricade, blank, bridge, cavern, camp, chamber, coast, commute, colony, compound, couch, crack, flat, forest, gate, ground, habitat, hollow, hospital, hap, interface, itinerary, layer, map, node, odyssey, plantation, platform, resort, retreat, roller coaster, sanctuary, salon, shade, shelter, stage, threshold, trajectory, tunnel, turnstile, vortex, wall, web. Keeping with our approach of describing, we don't analyze the meaning of these figures, but we tell stories about their etymological origins. Similar to the analysis of metaphors, etymological stories can be used to figure out horizons of meaning. Some words have complex layers of meaning and are used differently in different languages, even if they might share the same etymological root. Their meaning might also change over time. For spatial research, etymologies can be used speculatively to develop multiple readings for spatial interpretations and to further stimulate empirical analysis. As you will have noticed, these spatial figures are quite different from the ones that we have been discussing. In the introduction to the book, we distinguish between two types of spatial figures, which we call topological and topographic. So topological figures are basically spatial diagrams that represent abstract types of spatial arrangements or relationships between objects or entities. The four figures that we have been discussing in our symposium might qualify as topological figures. They can be traced back to ideal types of spatial practice, each of which relates objects or entities by imagining or acting upon them in a very specific way. They might delimit, connect, transverse, or identify points. Topographic figures, the ones that we collect in our book, can be derived from very concrete spatial arrangements. They are based on an empirical distribution of localized objects and entities forming this spatial figure. A bridge, a camp, an anthill would be vivid examples of this. In essence, topographic figures emerge empirically, similarly to the way in which metaphors work in language. And I have to say, we were very inspired here by the work of Lakoff and Johnson and his book, Metaphors We Live By, where they basically explore the metaphors hidden, inscribed in everyday terms and words, and how these metaphors shape the way in which we understand the world. It is important to note, though, that these two types of figures are not mutually exclusive, and some of these figures can move back and forth between topographic and topological functions. For example, the network can be both a spatial metaphor used to make sense of a very specific, empirically observable arrangement, but also as an abstract figure, as an abstract spatial diagram that produces and organizes space in a very specific way. In addition to this more, let's say, abstract and conceptual work that we were doing, we were also, and we are also interested in understanding more empirically as well, the vectors of the contemporary refiguration of spaces. So by looking at the stories, we basically identify four thematic areas that revolve around the problems of extimacy, uninhabitability, ferality, and splintering.
The initial idea was to think about how to theorize in such a heterogeneous research consortium, which is also a huge one, and with a lot of different people, a lot of different disciplines, and how to bring these people together around one theme or one question. And this is why we initiated the different workshops, multimodal workshops with the projects, and trying to get into conversation with them. So the theme of the Anthropocene was not so present, or is not so present for the book, although there is one section in the book that really connects with the Anthropocene, the section of ferality and how humans and non-humans entangle and form spaces. So the book somehow has a broader scope, trying to really involve all the different topics of the CRC and translate it into visual thinking and getting something back from visual thinking and the inspiration you get when you look at the figures that Nikolaus Ganzerer, for example, produces.
Adding to that, for me there is like a premise to the book, and there is also a surprise. And the premise was this idea that we were saying we have moved too quickly in the SFB and how we do theory in the SFB, and we have moved too quickly from the empirical research to the four figures. And there is like a space of in between where analytical work can happen in a way that is closer to each of the empirical fields. And from the beginning, before we had a book idea, this was our goal, to explore that space in between the field, the spatial arrangements that people are doing research on, and these four spatial figures. And the idea was from early on to diversify that and to kind of find a level of conceptualization that is in this middle ground, so to speak. So that was the premise, and I think it kind of delivers on that. But for me, like, really the surprise was to identify these kind of vectors of refiguration around the home, the city, the ecological and the digital. Okay, well, these are fields which are pretty obvious to look for. But then the kind of concepts that we start to develop around them, like these ideas of extimacy and so on. And I think this is also, for me, like a question mark, to what extent this sort of discussion about vectors of refiguration, extimacy, and inhabitability ferality and splintering, to what extent that can also make a larger contribution to the SFP and maybe become part of our common research agenda. So that was a surprise to find those vectors. And it's also like an open question. How are we going to continue working on that as a collective research center?
Extimacy, turning homes inside out. The first thematic section or vector of spatial refiguration revolves around the home. What we found interesting about many of the stories was that they challenged the Western idea of the home as a place of intimacy. Traditionally, the home has been seen as a private and sacred space where individuals can retreat from the public world and be authentic, that is, who they really are. However, many of the collected stories speak of homes under conditions of extimacy. The term, originally coined by Lacan, refers to how our most intimate desires are shaped by the external, the strange, the alien. Similarly, we are interested in the ways in which the space of the home is expressed, exposed, and intersects by logics that undo or challenge experiences of intimacy, that speak of homes that are turned inside out, territorialized, and how they become something else, a dangerous or a defenseless place, or a place of political and economic struggle. In the process, homes often become temporary public spaces for a variety of reasons. Here is an example.
Blind Date, a story by Daniel Gronefeld, student researcher in the sub-project Locative Media. Although hours had passed since sunset, Leo was not surrounded by complete darkness. The intrusive light of a street lamp had only reluctantly allowed itself to be dimmed by a picnic blanket that barely covered the large window of his living room. Leo's iPhone buzzed and the screen lit up. "I'm a bit late, sorry," the message said. Leo opened Grindr and replied, "No problem, see you on the dark side, smiley." The screen switched off, his eyes narrowing in the obscurity until the black and white poster on the wall with the words, "But we are not animals," became legible again. Thoughts flickered through Leo's mind. What image would the guy have of Leo, given that the few furnishings thrown together by inheritance and leftovers from the previous tenant could likely be the most private insight he could ever have, aside from sex, of course. In fact, he really had no reason to worry about it. In his personal dark room, their eyes would be busy making out more than the mere silhouettes of their bodies, and the furniture would quickly recede from attention. During the time Leo had lived with his ex-partner, Ali, he wasn't allowed to use their flat as a place for his occasional Grindr encounters. For Ali, home was a safe space, meant exclusively for himself, his partner, and close friends. On their very first date, Leo had received Ali in the small room of Leo's shared flat, although Ali lived alone in a spacious apartment. Only after they had been a couple for a year or so did Leo move in with Ali. Whenever Leo met other men at their places, he never stayed the night. He did this in an attempt to separate the physical side from the emotions he reserved for his partner. Now that he was single and living alone again, Leo offered his flat as a meeting place in case the other didn't or couldn't do so, or was outside the 20-minute radius that quite consistently delineated Leo's dating activities. He usually felt fairly secure inviting strangers, and so it was today. The man who was keeping him waiting in the gloom of his living room had seemed somewhat uneasy about Leo's less than common suggestion of meeting in the dark. He hesitated at first, but then agreed on the condition that Leo could receive him naked and seated on the floor. "A safety measure, smiley," he explained. Having been worried about his safety in his early days of Grindr, Leo was able to empathize.
He had always shared his location with a friend and placed his belongings just in front of the door so that he could hear his keys scratching over the floor in case someone entered the flat while they were in action. He had stopped doing so because the effort didn't seem to him to justify the lack of danger he felt. By now, Liu was starting to feel a little cold and, even more worryingly, nowhere near as horny as he had been at the time he had invited the guy over. He flicked through the photographs that had triggered his desire for an immediate meeting less than 2 hours ago. As the anticipation was returning, a message popped up. "I'm at the door. Let me in." With a hint of a smile on his lips, his mouth quietly formed the word "please," voicing his understanding of the emoji that marked the end of the sentence.
Spatial figure, salon. The French term salon can be linked to the old Italian word salona, which both referred to a large hall or living room. The French and Italian words likely have roots in the Latin word salone or saloneum, derived from salire, which means to leap or to jump. The idea is that such gatherings in the reception room might be lively and animated, akin to leaping and jumping conversations. The word has taken on different meanings over time, such as reception room of a Parisian lady. In 1810, the woman who hosts a salon is a salonniere. The meaning gathering of fashionable people is from 1888. The meaning annual exhibition of contemporary paintings and sculpture in Paris is from 1875, and it's originally being held in one of the salons of the Louvre, from a secondary sense of the French word spacious or elegant apartment for reception of company or artistic exhibitions. The meaning establishment for hairdressing and beauty care is from 1913.
An inevitability. Urbanity is not what it used to be. The second cluster of stories contains stories about urban spaces. What characterizes them is that they challenge the idea of the city as a space that can be appropriated by individuals, groups, and communities, and thus become a site of affective attachment, individual emancipation, or cultural representation. The city has long been imagined in this way, as a space where the struggles for recognition and the right to the city, understood as the right to shape the city by inhabiting it, take place. Yet many of the stories we collected challenge this reading of the city, showing vividly the impossibility of appropriating urban space. The term uninhabitability was coined recently by Abdoumalik Simone. It invites us to rethink how people relate, or rather do not relate, to the city. Interestingly, Simone imagines an uninhabitability as something that might be liberating, as it enables, and I quote here, residents to spiral in and out, propel themselves into the larger urban surrounds, and then bear back down again into the familiar places now rendered unfamiliar. Our stories of urban uninhabitability do not have necessarily such a liberating connotation. These are rather stories about violence, alienation, dislocation, fear, and misrecognition. Here is one example.
Where to Flee, a story by Qusay Amar, architect and research associate in the subproject Architectures of Asylum. Rashid tried to take a deep breath, but the fresh breeze of the morning dawn got stuck between his ribs, tightening his chest. The pickup truck was ready to head to the south. He climbed up and squeezed himself between a sleepy woman and a young man with white paint on his sleeves. There were about 10 people on the truck. Rashid didn't know any of them. He was thinking about his family, not sure if he wanted to go back to the village to see if they were still there. If they weren't, where would he search for them?
Since the last attack of Boko Haram 3 weeks ago, he had been on his own. His mother was able to convince his father to leave the village, but it was too late. The family had decided to leave after the year's first harvest, but a week later, Boko Haram took over the village. They killed many and kidnapped the young girls. During the melee, he hid in the forest, the only one who was able to run away. About a week ago, he started walking south, avoiding the military checkpoint he had heard about. While on foot, he met some people on the truck, also heading to Lagos, where Rashid would try to find his uncle Mohammed, and hitched a ride. Arriving at the vastness of Lagos, he headed to the market his uncle had once told him about. It was the biggest in West Africa, he had said, and was where he met up with clients who needed to exchange dollars or euros to Naira. At its rowdy entrance, Rashid could not imagine how big it was, but already it seemed enough to swallow him. At a loss of where to start his search, Rashid relied on the fact that on the streets of Lagos, friends are very easily made. You can always find a willing one of the 24 million people to chat with. He described Uncle Mohammed to many, middle height, a white mustache, and a golden corner tooth, and to his surprise, the vendors somehow immediately knew whom he was talking about. But they sent him from one corner to the next, forcing him to remember details from each location as he tracked his way back, fish, a yam lady, and so on. It seemed impossible, simply too many stores. After searching and waiting for hours, it was his uncle who found him. The day was long and Rashid was now relieved. They hugged and he suddenly felt how hungry he was. They got two jollof rice dishes and sat together on the sidewalk and he told his uncle what had happened. In the evening they arrived at the compound where his uncle had lived for 10 years, only returning twice to visit his old northern village. The camp he shared with 25 others is illegal, Uncle Mohammed explained, because the city officially has no place for them from the north. The government doesn't want to have us here, he said. Theirs was built on rented land, but there was no contract to regulate, he continued. We pay for each square meter, but still nothing here belongs to us. A couple of weeks pass at the camp and Rashid, now a resident, has learned to ride a motorcycle. Through one of his uncle's compound friends, he agreed to work afternoon shifts driving people from the bus stop to their home in the camp. But the young men working at the landowners bully him and hit Rashid, charging him more than the others for using the parking place while waiting for customers. Today is Sunday, a day that looks much like the day Rashid arrived. Together with his new friend Ahmad, a kid born in the camp, he now plays football at the unofficial IDP Sunday League, where IDP teams travel from one camp to the next to enjoy football matches. On this particular day, Rashid had walked a lot earlier, and his left foot also hurt after the last football game where he crashed into a boy twice as big. Later in the day, Uncle Mohammed pulls Rashid aside, telling him that he must now manage his life on his own. Continuing, he said if Rashid didn't find a shift on the motorcycle, he would have to get out onto the streets and find something else to do. But here, at the camp, no one takes care of you, and there is no governmental support. You are invisible. Rashid sees young kids selling stuff to people in the cars. At 15 years of age, back in his hometown, he would have been at school. He was interested in becoming a police officer, but his uncle had laughed at the idea and told him he needed a lot of money for that. When Rashid tells Ahmed that he used to go to school and that he can write and read, he answers, "But you're riding a motorcycle now. It doesn't matter anymore."
Special figure, compound. The noun compound has its etymological roots both in the Latin verb componere, which reflects the idea of bringing elements together, and the Arabic verb qamat, which roughly translates to be built up or to be formed. Thus, the word had been used first in English during the early Middle Ages to refer to a combination of two or more things, and has proliferated to a variety of physical, conceptual, and metaphorical contexts ever since. For example, in the course of the British expansion, it came to be used as a term to describe an enclosed residence or the enclosure for a factory or settlement of Europeans in the East, probably further influenced by the Dutch notion of kampung or the Portuguese adaptation of the Malay kampong in the 1670s. Later, the term was also used in South Africa to refer to diamond miners' camps in the 1890s and to large fenced-in residences in the 1940s. In addition, today the usage of it has spread to the realms of finance, law, and chemistry, always revolving around the basic idea of an arrangement.